Okay, so then we will pick up from here then. And as you say, brokerage operations and customer account management. For brokerage operations, we'll look at the know your customer process, and then we will look at the opening of accounts, the procedures and the steps. We will pay some attention to discretionary accounts, as those are critically important that we consider the salient points and the different types of discretionary accounts. We would go into customer account management in the second part of the morning, and we'd look at the management of customer accounts, the account management and record keeping processes and some of the requirements. And we will at the end spend some time looking over some internal structures that we need in order to be successful as a brokerage firm. So looking at brokerage operations and focusing on the know your customer process and the investment advice process. Some of the salient elements or aspects of the know your customer process you would have already touched when you did the conduct of business segment of this workshop. And this would involve looking at the customer's investment horizon. You need to be careful of the customer's objectives, be able to assess the risk factors and the risk tolerance of the customer, look at investment strategies that you can propose to the customers and know the reason why you adopt one strategy and not another, be able to make choice and assist the customer in choice of financial assets, and also be able to conduct market analysis, do risk return analysis, and look at the fundamentals for given investment advice. So we'll spend a moment on each of these now. The customer advice, the know your customer process requires us to have to pay some attention to the customer's investment horizon. If we recall from the previous work we would have done, especially in the bond section and the types of instrument section, the customer's investment horizon is measured in part by the length of time that the customer has to invest, the length of time that the customer has to wait for his investment to grow. And that would be related to things like age, for example, or in the stage of career as well. It would be related to the stage in life, the stage in learning, or it would be related to the position in the hierarchy of an organization where your customer is employed. It may be related to the age of the business, the private enterprise that the customer is involved in, if an entrepreneur. So your typical examples of a long-term investment horizon would be where the investment process has the target of retirement age. So a young person or a middle-aged person investing for purposes of retirement, you can say that person has a long investment horizon. A short investment horizon, on the other hand, would be where a customer has funds that the customer would like to have invested, but those same funds the customer needs in a period, let's say, within a couple months or within a year. Or it may also be an indefinite period, but it is related to the volatile or the unpredictable moment in which the money may be needed. So for example, if a customer sold his house or sold his business and is in the market for a new house or a new business, you do not know when that customer would be successful. So that will be a short investment horizon that they would have for those particular funds. You may find that in any event, to close a deal will take 3 months or 2 months. Once the deal is done, to complete all the legal work will take 2 or 3 months. And so you can say that person has a 3-month horizon. That's a short-term investment horizon. Or a person is relocating from one country to another and is just waiting for the school term to finish in order to relocate during the vacation. And so you are at January, and the person's funds that they have, you know, is going to be needed at the relocation month somewhere in August or September. So those are things that may influence your decision on the investment horizon. But this, it would be an important aspect of the know your customer process. The customer's objectives is important that we pay attention to what the customer's objective is, who comes to invest. An investing customer who is looking at retirement would have a different objective from an investment customer who is actually looking for income support, for example. And income support would be something that is trying to find additional income to what I'm earning in my day job from the funds that I have to be invested. The broker is looking at these funds and is seeing that the objectives for income support is somewhat different or at variance in a way with the objective that would be, for example, estate planning purposes. If the investor is looking at having funds put aside for and grow for leaving a legacy for his estate to his survivors, for example, it means that you would have objectives related to that. And that would be different from if the investor is looking to put aside funds or to prepare himself for retirement with the funds that he has or with the continuous investment of funds during the next several years. You're actually in the presence of a different objective. So the customer's objective is very important for knowing the reasons for investing and also the type of advice that you can give to the customer. And these objectives may change over the life of the client, the life of the customer being your client. At the beginning, your objectives that you determine may be one thing, and in 2 or 3 years, you may find that this customer is now married, is now having a family started, and so his investment objectives begin to change. He now has to put aside funds for the next 17 years for college education, and so the objectives would have to be adjusted at that time. The Know Your Customer process in this way, therefore, we see in very early, is a continuous one. It's not a fixed one at the start of your relation with the client, but it is continuous during your servicing of the clients. The customer's risk factor is an important element, an important aspect of the Know Your Customer process. And the risk factors would be all related to how can the customer tolerate or survive the possible loss of the funds that he's coming to you to invest, or that you have encouraged him or her that he should invest. How tolerant would they be? How can they possibly survive the loss? And this is important because risk is the potential, the possibility of not achieving what you set out to achieve. That is in terms of the returns. But it is also losing, the potential and the possibility of losing because of the failure of the investment choice that you made, the failure of the instrument in which you decided to invest. So what is the tolerance level of the customer that you are speaking with? That's a question that you have to answer. You see, combined with the investment horizon of the customer, we need to find whether the customer is high risk or low risk so that we can determine which type of investment, and in fact, even among classes and types of investment, which in fact investment or which issuer we can recommend to the client. Of course, the high risk investment, as you have done in the previous sessions, we would have seen in the previous sessions, the high risk investment tend to come at a higher rate, higher return rate, higher expected return rate as compared to the low risk. But low risk means lower return, but greater certainty. So the risk tolerance is important when you look at knowing your customer. You don't want to offer a customer an instrument or security or an investment which has a high risk because that customer is low risk and is not therefore tolerable or able to survive or be exposed properly to high risk instruments. And as we see, knowing the customer's horizon is important. Knowing the customer's risk tolerance is important. So you combine both of them to determine that on these risk factors, this is where my customer is, and this is what I can advise a customer regarding investment. The Know Your Customer process and the investment advice process requires us to determine investment strategies. The investment strategy is, in fact, really not a strategic thing, or the term strategy refers to your broad principled direction in which you are going. And it means the things or the place where you are targeting to be, the things that you are targeting to achieve, to acquire. And this all relates to the factors that we just mentioned. It relates to the investment horizon. So based on the investment horizon, your strategy is informed. By the investment objective that you have agreed or determined with the client, your strategy is informed. And your strategy is also informed by the risk tolerance, a level that you have assessed with the client for him or herself, the case of a company, for that company. And here we have an example of a customer that has a long investment horizon, is having a retirement objective, and is able to sustain a loss that you have assessed, say, to be a high-risk factor. So that is a strategy basis on which you will determine, I will advise this customer to invest in a portfolio of this or that type of security. So he may include bonds in there, he may include some high volatility stocks, for example, because the horizon is long and you can expect to plateau out or to increase over time with that customer. A short-term investment strategy might be, for example, informed by the fact that the customer has a short investment horizon and his retirement objective is a retirement objective, but because the investment horizon is short, you are looking at not a long time, and you are looking at a low risk factor because there is not enough time to recoup if there is a possible loss of the investment, of the amount invested. So investment strategies are informed by, in summary, your investment horizon, your objectives of the customer, and the risk tolerance you have advised, you have assessed for the customer. The choice of financial assets is part of your Know Your Customer process as well, and it is part of your investment advisory services. You must be in a position to, based on the investment strategy that you have established, determine and advise the customer on which type of investment or which input into the portfolio that you will manage for the customer is best to achieve the strategy, the investment strategy that you have determined is proper. Here we have in the ECCU and on the ECSE, the options of stocks or shares in publicly listed companies. You have bonds, you have corporate papers, you have sovereign papers that are long-term, bonds and notes, or you have treasury bills, and you have short-term commercial paper these days as well. As the market grows, you will have things like repurchase agreements, and you will have things like mutual funds or trust funds that would be also available to the client. But the choice of financial assets is one that you would have to make based on the investment strategy. The Know Your Customer process requires you to assist the customer with the choice of financial assets, and you can best do it if you would have done the steps that we mentioned earlier on related to the risk assessment, related to the investment horizon assessment. And then you now go back to the session you had yesterday on portfolio management and the best portfolio building, and you recall that diversification is key to minimizing risk, to minimizing volatility, and to giving the best opportunity for success in the investment portfolio that you've recommended for the customer. Market analysis and the risk return analysis is very important. You need to know how the market works. You need to know how active the market is. You need to be very familiar with the securities that are available at any one time or that are available now and available seasonally, available based on prospectuses that have been issued, available based on maturing the securities that you are aware of, and it is likely that the issuer will reissue. You must know the market and know what's available in the market very well. You must know how the market operates in respect of the securities laws, the regulations, the ECSE rules, registry rules. You must be very familiar with those and have them at your fingertips. What you don't have at your fingertips, you must have available right there at your desk in your manuals and in your compendium of regulations and rules. Market analysis and risk return analysis is extremely important, and it is one of the basis on which the regulators will assess whether your firm is indeed positively correct or not when referring to complaints that may come from customers. The efficiency with which you do these will tell the soundness with which you are performing your function as brokers, and will also help in the recommendations that you make and in the assessment of anyone of those recommendations as well. The most sound recommendations are always based on facts and based on a sound preparation through the customer, the Know Your Customer process and the customer service advisory process. Now we want to look at opening of new accounts. Now, to open new accounts, you actually go through a process which, if your firm already has this established, it's very easy for you to pick up one of the new customer account forms and go through them. At this stage, I'd like us to review the customer account form. Do you have copies? I'm asking. You have copies of the intermediary supervisory manual?
Yes. That's the operations and procedures manual.
That one is for the depository. You should have one which says yes, you should have one that has the word supervisory in it, or intermediary.
It says intermediary operations and procedures manual. That's the one you're talking about?
Okay. Just let me make sure. Okay, and that one, let's go to page. From what you received this morning, did you receive intermediary operations and procedures manual? Yes, that's the one?
Yes, that's what we have.
Okay, great. On that one, can we go to page 51? Let me just make sure it is that page. And on that page, you will see the new customer account form. Can you go all the way back there, see if you find it for me, please?
Yes,
that's on the page.
On the page? Okay, so let us look at the new customer account form, and by looking at it, complete the process of a review of the, now at the risk of okay, I'll try not to torpedo this, but we try to share the phone. Okay, so on that, let's go to the page 51, and on that page, so the customer comes in, I'd like you to note a few things very important here. So let's refer to those. The firm assigned ID, you can see there. That is referring to the fact that each customer will have an identification number that you will use most of the companies are moving away from the internal firms in the customer ID, but most companies are remaining with it. The reason being that in addition to the securities, the ECSE and ECSN securities work that is done for publicly listed securities, companies also do work with their clients for other type of business, other financial assets. And so they maintain two numbers for them, the unique number that they find with the Central Security Depository and in dealing with the ECSE, and also they assign a number from the firm itself to that particular client. But here you need to put the firm's ID as well as the firm's customer assigned ID. Now, ECSE's ID can go with either one of these, but most of the firms, if you are in a firm that is already having its documentation up and running, you will find one being the firm's ID and the other being the ECSE's UID. I want to tell you about the importance of this. The importance of this is that each customer must be identified by a number that could never be confused with any other customer for all of the reporting, for all of the transactions, for all of the audit trails. Let's go to Section A of the new customer account form. The account type, you can have two types of accounts. You can have a cash account or you can have margin accounts. A margin account is one where you can give credit to the customer, where you can courier transactions for the customer without having the customer's money, where you can sell securities for the customer without having securities in the customer's name. That is of the process which you generally would hear called the short selling process. We do not have margin accounts permitted in the ECSM at this time. So that is one that you will meet sometime in the future. But for now, there are no margin accounts. Some firms do have special arrangements with their clients when they have discretionary accounts in which they spend and then they take from the client by that debit from the client's accounts. Those are not really margin accounts. Those are special arrangements that are had directly with the clients. So this will generally be cash accounts and in the account type. Now, the second aspect of the account type will be the registration in terms of ownership and in terms of classification by type of investor. So you can have an individual account, and it means it's owned exclusively and without more by this person who is your client in his name only. Or you can have a joint account in which the account is owned and operated by more than one person or more than one entities. Then we classify by corporate accounts, and the distinction here is that it is not an individual, but it is corporate. It's a legal entity, it's not a human person, but a legal person. And we classify by banks, investment company, or other as well. The reason for this classification in your records is to be able to determine where you will have different types of operation with a client. Because a client might be a client, but also is a bank. So you want to identify that upfront and to know that in your records. So all your clients who are banks as one place. Your clients who are investment companies as well, you will treat them differently because investment companies generally have clients of themselves who may also be clients of yours. So you want to identify that as early as possible in the relationship with the clients. Information about the holder of the account. We need a name, and here we only have name. You actually need first name, second name, last name. You need at least three names in order to assist with the identification of clients throughout the life of your relationship with your various clients. It may be so because we are multi-territory, multi-jurisdictional in terms of states, that you have the same person appearing in three different countries with three different brokers. But it may also be that you have three different persons in three different countries and they all have the same first name and last name. Generally, they may not have the same second and third name. And so it's important that we keep all of those. The address must be as detailed as possible, and the address must be as current as possible. It must have, if somebody gave you a post office box, they should also give you a physical address. You need physical address as well as mailing address. And the new forms and most of the company's new forms also take from this template, and they have two sections of the address, the postal address and the physical place of residence address. Country of birth is important and citizenship is important. And this is critical not only for our work, but for the relationship between our firms and the exchange and the CSD and other entities in other countries. You've heard of FATCA, for example. And both in relations with the US, Canada, and on the American continent, and The European Union, on the other hand, we find that we do have to identify our clients by citizenship in order to do reporting required under those acts like FATCA and so. And in terms of investor type, residential, non-residential, and this resident alien and foreign alien and all that, you know what those means, but the point is that you identify the place that the persons are. This is important because whereas investments may be tax-free at our end, having to remit interest income and dividend to persons in other territories may have to be processed with withholding tax. And so it's important that we have all these records now rather than having to search for them later on. You take telephone numbers, and of course, in these days, you enhance the form by taking also email addresses. It's important to take email addresses as well, so that is included on the form. The point here is that you need detailed personal information on the person as far as contacting them and classifying them as concerned for business purposes and for correspondence purposes. Information about the holder of the account, if it's a company. If it's a company, you will take the company's name. And in addition to the details of the company being not date of birth, but date of incorporation, country of incorporation, even if the company is registered in a second country, you take also country of registration in that second country. And so you add an additional page to this form and in this customer's file. And you put in the principal type of business in which the company is involved. This is important because it helps you to be able to determine in your customer process and in your investment advisory process the horizons, the risk tolerance and so on of the company. And you can look into financial statements and make assessments just like you can look at employment records of an individual, employment levels, pay and remuneration and so. The principal officers you must take, and this is extremely important because you take the principal officers so that you can know who is speaking on behalf of the company when they are receiving instructions from a company. So this is important where it is companies. So now we are moving from page 51 to page 52. Are you with me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Certain disclosures must be made, and you should ensure that you receive that disclosure. Again, the Know Your Customer process is at the start, but it's also renewed annually, in particular for companies and for individuals who are not active. You want to renew and make sure you have up-to-date information on them. So an annual review of customers' records is important. The information we receive is specific to a firm. If it's an individual, is again different, but we need to have information as are outlined here. We need to look at joint ownership. We need to look at employment levels. We need to look at whether there are any pledges, whether there are any commitment that a person has over the securities or intend to do over the securities that they want you to purchase for them. Yeah. So those are the things that you want to put in. If you are open an account and there is a joint holder, you want to have a separate information. The joint holder's information must be there, and also the person with you, the original principal person, open the account must be with you as well. If it's a company, you want to know if the securities laws or regulations governing that company is allowing it to do the investment or if there are any restrictions. So here is where you put that in C2. We will need to look at the level of ownership that persons have of the company and that the company has of other companies. If the company is a subsidiary or if the company has subsidiaries, you want to take all those information. So you can very well see that some of this personal information are fitting into this form. Others of them you will have to actually append to this form. But this guide tells you the type of information that you should request from the company. Now, in your examination, your ECSM workshop examination, we are actually going to test you on this as well. We are going to test you on it because the Know Your Customer process is actually synthesized in the knowledge of what you have on your records regarding that investor. So if it's an individual investor, what do you need to receive from the investor? What do you need to have in record from the investor? If it's a company, what do you need to receive from the company and what do you need to have on records from the company? Okay. Then you need to have, let's go to D on the same page, page 52 here. Let's go to D on page 52. What does the investor want you to do with the funds that he receives from his investment or that you receive on his behalf? Should these funds be paid to him directly, paid into which account? How often should they be transferred to him? Should it be immediately? How does he want his money to be handled by you? This is this is an instruction that you should have so that whenever you act in one way, it must be that way in which you would have recorded with the customer your own agreement with him as to how he wants you to treat, she wants you to treat the funds that are received. Similarly, for securities, where do you want your securities kept? Does the investor want you to hold the securities on his behalf, or does the investor want you to keep the securities in that investor's own account at the central securities depository? So the registered owner of the security is the registered owner in the depository, or the registered owner of the securities is you on behalf of the investor, and then you in turn will notify the investor all the time of what his balances are with you from time to time. So that's what this section is. It tells you what you can do in terms of with the transactions that you process on behalf of the clients, what you do with the proceeds, what you do. Now, section P, we go now to page 53 of the supervisory manual. And here's where it is this part of the, it is this document that you return to for your revision as to what things are required when you are opening a new account or when you are renewing your, when you are reviewing the file of your customer. So in E, we have the individual account holder's personal and financial information. You need this information. You need the birth date, and the birth date is actually registered by brokers in the registry, in the Central Securities Depository. You check your customer all the time to make sure that the date you have is there. Usually you take the ID card, two pieces of ID, because that ID card has the birth date on it. It's not that he tells you, but you can see it proven in there. The marital status is important because that helps you to determine the investment strategy as well. The dependence, it tells you the risk tolerance. Can he afford to lose? What are his obligations? The occupation. How versatile he would be from job to job, for example, the number of years employed, and it helps you to tell the experience and so on, the business area. The annual income, why would you need a bank annual income of the investor? You need to know more or less the source of funds, and you will need to have that on record so that if one day, in this anti-money laundering age that we live in, if one day he comes with some big sum of money, you will know to ask, well, tell me about the proceeds, or at least pay attention to due diligence regarding the proceeds of those funds that all of a sudden you're receiving from him that he wants to invest. So all this is important, and section E is critical that you pay attention to that. If it's a joint holder, similarly, you want to get that information. And if it's a company, you want to look at the company's turnover, the company's profit level, the company's earnings before income taxes and depreciation over the last few years. If it's a new startup company, you want to know the projections that they have for these as well. So this is information that gives you the leverage to be able to put in your investment strategy, the type of funding, the type of advice that you can give this customer, the assets you can recommend, the strategy you can build. But it also helps you to pay attention for your due diligence when you are dealing with the same customer during the upcoming years and months. And then you take references from the customer. Here, it's in the session later on. It would be explained to you the type of banking information you need from the customer, and it would be done in relation to corporate action and so. We don't spend much time on that here. Investment risk at the very start and all the time when you speak with an investor, it's always important to be assessing and reassessing the level of risk tolerance that this investor has. And this is where you can just put a note based on your impression on interviewing the client, whether he has a high risk tolerance, a low risk tolerance, and always on your forms have a place where you can write your impression of that or your reason for coming with it, with that, for putting down that as your assessment. And so investment objectives, what is it, income, is it low-term, long-term growth or long-term growth? Is it short-term trading or what? Whatever it is, you know. So those are the key things that you want to gather from your customers. Now, if you go to page of the same intermediary manual, if you go to page 55, we should pay attention to this point here. You can have a customer who does not want to disclose some information to you or want to only disclose partial information to you. He may want, for example, to give you information regarding the bonus policy, sorry, the income, the monthly income. I mean, he may not want to give you any income, any information regarding the bonuses, or maybe he's unable to. He may want to give you information regarding himself, but he may not want to give you information regarding his spouse's income. He may want to not to involve his wife at all, but she has a marital status and, you know, she's a joint holder, but he doesn't want her income to be involved in his customer records with you at all. Whatever information you need and he doesn't want to disclose, you can in fact get an indemnification for that, which is here attestation of refusal to provide information. Okay, so if the customer refuses to supply any of the information requested in the form that your firm has designed, then the customer must, in his or her handwriting, sign in fact saying that I don't want to give this information, okay? If the customer doesn't really need your financial advice, for example, advisory service, you say, I ain't giving you all this information because I don't want financial advice. Or I will just come with my thing to you and you will just put it. Again, you will have to determine, the principal will have to determine whether to accept that customer, do your due diligence on the reason why he's not giving that information. But as long as you agree to accept an investor and you are waiving this information from your form not being recorded, then you need to use this form here. It's extremely important because if you had an incomplete form and the regulators, whether ECSC or the commission, comes and looks at this form and you do not have this waiver signed by the investor, then that would represent a default on your part or a failure on your part. Always have the investor certify that the information that you have on his form is correct, whether this form or any other form, and the investor should sign it. And that is what this section I is asking you to do. Okay? I want you to notice that in J, the registered representative would do most of these interviews with clients as well as the annual reviews, and that rep must also sign it. I have seen forms where the rep do not even put on their license number. You need to put on your license number because these are formal and official requirements, and you should put on your name, sign that you have done this interview and have it recorded. And the acceptance of the client to the firm, a person should not be, or a company should not become a client of a firm, and the principal, the lead principal, has not accepted it. Any principal can. I tend to say lead principal because usually one principal is really operating as the supervisory principal. That principal must sign off on the form. Sometimes where you have two principals, one is the supervisory principal, the other is the compliance officer for the firm. But at least one of them must sign accepting the client when you do a new customer form. Okay. So that takes care of the slide that we are now looking at. Takes care of the slide that we are looking at on the presentation there. And it also takes care of the comments I wanted to make regarding the cash and securities transfer instructions for the client. The customer's transfer instruction to us must be very clear regarding securities. All right, so we go back to the PowerPoint presentation on your screen now. We are leaving the supervisory manual for a moment. Brokers can hold securities on behalf of clients, but this must be nominee accounts. Again, when you come to the practical session, we will show you how you create and hold nominee accounts. And we will also show you the form that you use to report on the securities that you are holding on behalf of clients. The securities can also be held and should properly be held as far as possible in the customer's account. Each customer is uniquely identified in our system, and each customer has their accounts. Now, a customer can have several accounts, You can have accounts with your firm. You can have 4, 5, 10, 15, 25. You can have hundreds of accounts for a single customer. The thing is that the securities must be held in that customer's account. A customer can have accounts, securities in various accounts for any reason. You can have securities in all in the same account, and that too is not a problem. But you must have your instructions from your customer as to where to hold the securities. You'd never do not hold customer securities in your nominee account or your own account at any time overnight, not even over one night, for any reason whatsoever. There is no reason to do it. So to open a customer account takes only a few minutes, and before you acquire securities for a new customer, you need to open accounts for the customer in the CSD. You need instructions as to what to do with customer's money, receipts for the customer from the customer, and deposits of funds received from the issuers for the customer. These could be held in your segregated bank account, as well as it could be held in your customer's account in your own bank as well, to which he gives you power of attorney, or which he doesn't give you power of attorney to, but from which you can ask him to process debits in favor of the securities business that you're doing on his behalf. The key and most important thing is that never should a broker hold customer's money in any account other than customer's account, either the segregated bank account of the broker for customer's funds, or in the customer's own bank account to which the customer has given the broker a power of attorney to process debits. So, what are some of the other documents that you may need when processing customers' accounts? Of course, you know, from what we have done, the customer ID is important. The customer new account form is important. You know, if it's a joint owner, we also need the customer's ID, two pieces of ID, and put in all this information that we have on the form. You also need them verified as well. You need the customer to sign off saying that he has read the information and the information is correct. If there is a discretionary account, you need a discretionary account authorization. And we'll spend a minute on discretionary account authorization in a moment. And the discretionary account authorization, what do you mean by discretionary account? A discretionary account, we mean those accounts on which you can carry out a transaction for a client without calling the client to do it. That's a discretionary account where you have the opportunity, you have the mandate, not the opportunity, but the mandate to, at any opportunity you get, carry out a transaction on behalf of the client. That's what a discretionary account is. And we will show you the different types in a while. But the other document you need when opening new accounts is that if a client is going to give you discretion over any aspect of your dealing in securities on a client's behalf, that is a discretion, and you need his authorization for it, and that should be in writing. You need a margin agreement when in the future we allow margin accounts. We do not have margin accounts, understand. You need a corporate resolution where it's a company. Where it's a company, you need a corporate resolution. That resolution should say, and in the supervisory manual, you will see that as well. There's a sample corporate resolution at the end of the supervisory manual. Please review that in your spare time. But this is one of the additional documents you need when a company is going to become your client. You need to update this if necessary during the life of your relationship with the company.
What manual did you say?
This intermediaries, the same one we are looking in
your company. Okay.
Yes. At the end of that, you will see a sample resolution for companies when they become your customer.
Okay.
Thank you. If it's a partnership, similar to the company resolution, you need a partnership agreement, because that will tell you agreement between the firm and the partnership. Sorry, you don't need a partnership agreement itself. You need them to tell you who is going to be doing business on behalf of the partnership with your company. And a securities transfer form, if the securities are held elsewhere, you need that transfer form. Or if you're going to transfer securities from personal account to the new account that you're opening, you need those transfer forms. Those forms you will see in the session this afternoon. And joint account agreement. If two persons are not present when a joint account has been opened for you, you would need the joint account agreement or at least some sort of letter or something. We use a big word agreement here, but you need something for your files that certifies that this second person has consented to be, if not a minor, of course, it has consent, a minor of the person opening the account, say like the child or the niece or something like that. But you need consent from the second person that I consent to be a joint holder and I consent that this person is going to act on my behalf in the joint account. And the other document you need, which is an internal document, is your new account log, and that is an internal document that every firm needs to have in relation to the opening of new accounts. So you should be able to go back and see on the log on which day was this thing, this customer recorded as a new customer in your firm. The new account log is also in the supervisory manual. Let me see if I can get a page for you very quickly. Now, these are in the appendices towards the end of the firm. The corporate resolution, you can just take a note, you'll go to it later. The corporate resolution sample is on page 64. The corporate resolution sample is on page 64 of this very said manual. And you can find the new account log . Okay, location escaped me for a moment, but it's in there in one of the annexes and we can refer to it later. Moving on. Still in brokerage operation, let's spend a moment on discretionary accounts. There are three types of discretionary accounts that you would be able to open. The first type is where the customer gives you discretion by telling you, you can buy 100 SL Hotspur shares at the market when you think the time is right. Can you still see my screen? Great. What do we have discussion over here?
Choosing when the time is right.
We have discussion.
The purchase?
Over time.
We have discussion over the time. We have discussion over something that is not even mentioned here. What? The word is not there. Okay, if you're gonna buy, you're gonna buy.
Much to buy, the value?
The price.
The price, yeah.
You're gonna buy at a certain price. So you can see you have discussion over what price to buy at here. You have discussion over when you think that price is right. And then you buy at that time. So this is a discretionary account, all right. But what you buy, you don't have discretion over that, do you? Because this one says buy, and it tells you what you want to buy, what he wants. XYZ here means the shares, this could be SL. It could be TDC, it could be SLES, which is Lucilec, and so on. Okay? The second type of discretionary account is where the customer says to you, you can buy or sell at your discretion what you think would be suited for me, when you think it is of good value for me, and the amount you think is good at that price. But notice, this must be following the objectives of the account. So for this type of a discretionary account, you would need to have, in addition to the investment, the Know Your Customer process, you would need to have established not just an investment strategy that you told him about, you actually need to establish an agreement with him that shows up this discussion, boxed into objectives. So the objectives of the account and the nature of the account will be all written down in what is called an agreement, a discretionary account agreement. And this discretionary account agreement is the basis on which you will make sure that you do not make a mistake when you act on behalf of the customer. Do you find this sounds kind of risky? Can you see firms getting into trouble and possibly getting sued if they use discretionary accounts?
No, because you're following the objectives of the investor.
Exactly. No, because you're following the objectives of the investor. But there's also another important point.
They gave you that power, and you're also indemnified by the statement that they signed.
You indemnified by this. But is it possible, is this foolproof? I mean, is it, because you have this, are you totally out of the clear, out of the possibility of being sued or being called to task? Can you be challenged for negligence, for example? I mean, imagine you are very weak and woefully mistaken in the investment advice you gave, and in your process when setting up this agreement. The point is, even if you have a tight agreement, as licensed brokers, if you are wishy-washy and book-vap in your assessment, and an investor finds that he or she is victim to what you have done, they can challenge the agreement or the information that you use in establishing the agreement with them. Well, that is a far cry, but it's an option, and it's a possibility, a remote possibility that brokers should not put out of their mind, because an agreement in itself does not protect. The agreement must be signed, and we must have been actually doing and can be seen to have done the best that could have been done in the investment, in the Know Your Customer process and the investment analysis that we use in order to, as foundation for this agreement, in order to inform this agreement. Okay, the third type of discretionary account, and one in which an agreement is needed, but also a power of attorney is involved. This one is where a full power of attorney is granted. So in addition to the agreement, give the agreement on the question of what is bought, when is bought, and so on, there is a power of attorney over monies. So now you are able to dip your hand into the funds of the company, of the investor, and buy. Usually this power of attorney, this type of discretionary account is so strong that it gives a power of attorney over a particular bank account of the client inside a commercial bank, and the firm is able to debit that bank's account based on this power of attorney. Okay, so this is the third type of discretionary account. This then brings us to the three types of discretionary accounts. I should pause to ask if there are any questions on the distinction of these accounts. Everything is okay with that?
The agreement made.
Repeat the question, please.
Was there a form available for documenting the agreement?
We don't have a form, but okay. There's not a form because this agreement is this agreement is to be the agreement that you make with the client on the things that you and the client agree upon. So there's not really a form for it because it properly should be done using your. However, let's go to page 56 of the supervisory manual, the same one we were just looking at. And this is not really a form or a template. It's like a guide. It's a suggestion as to the key things that should be in the agreement. Is everyone there?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, okay. So first thing I want you to notice here, you see at the top we have the addendum to the customer account form. The reason is that it is not separate and apart from the files that you have for the customer. This must be part of the files that you have for the customer. And this discretionary accounting, you must renew it periodically. In itself, it says that it should be renewed every so and so time, but it is part of the whole process. So it's like an addendum to the form, but of all the information you have for the client, in addition to that, you now have this instruction, which is like a standing instruction, and it should be part of what you have as your record for relationship with the firm, with the client. So you can see that there's the account name and there's the account number. Why? Because you may have with the client agreement to deal in particular accounts and not overall. But this might be for all of the client's business, securities business with you, or it could be for part. The discretionary agreement must actually say that. So for example, it is not very common, but you may have discretionary account as regards to everything on the RGSM. All my investment related to regional government securities market investment. If I put an exception, I'll put an exception or something like that. It is under the discretionary account. None of my investment or security related to stocks, shares in companies is under this account. I can put that exception. In that case, you can put the actual accounts here as well. Anyway, I hereby authorize and empower the firm and so on and so forth. All that is in there. According to the ECSC rules, it is authorized to determine what securities, you can see that is there, make decisions as to what securities or other property shall be purchased, meaning if you purchase derivatives, if you purchase repurchase agreements, right? If you purchase commercial papers, whatever, you want all that to be in there. So this is like a sample, but it puts everything in there. And you can see in the next paragraph, it actually grants investment discretion powers. Yes, it grants investment discretion powers. Okay, so you read through these a little later on and just review it. It summarizes all the things that we were just mentioning, but those are the key things that goes into the discretionary agreement. But in principle, it is these three different types that we have being done.
Question.
Yes.
Well, with your expertise experience, which type of discretionary account is normally used in the ECCU? Well, predominantly.
Which type of discretionary account does what?
Do we use as brokers?
Okay, can you repeat the question from the top again for me? Sorry, I didn't hear.
Which type of discretionary account is normally used? Type 1, 2, or 3?
Normally. You know, anyone can be used, you know. I don't think I can answer normally. I'm not sure. Of course, it would be easy for me to think that the first one is common. It's easy to think of that because persons, based on their discussion with their clients, know that the client is looking for a single investment, one or two or three investment product, and may deal in that product, and may be given the discretion to deal in that product, and that type one, although it's free on price, There could also be a maximum and a maximum price at which I will buy, and there could also be a minimum price at which I will sell. So it could have that variation, but I could think that number one might be very often used by brokers, but either of the three can be used.
Okay.
All right?
Yeah.
I would think also that, for example, number four, right? In these times we have, in these days we have ease of communication by email that is now acceptable, electronic communication is acceptable. And when you are operating your firms, one of the forms that you will use with your client is the authorization to receive instruction by telephone. That's a form that you should use if you intend to receive instruction by telephone from a client. You actually have the client sign that form as well, or by fax or by email. You have the client sign that form with his signature in front of you, put the email address that he will be emailing you from, that you should accept his instructions from, and you use that. But I was just about to say that I would imagine that for brokers whose clients are, let's say, living in the Netherlands or outside of the ECCU, unable to visit the office or the branches of your office from time to time, but sufficiently developed relations enough, you would be able to use number three, type three, because based on the objects and the parameters you send, your client has gone to sleep, he gone in Austria or somewhere, he don't want to be calling you all the time, he don't want to be, he want to do that once a year or something like that, receive statements quarterly, so he gives you power of attorney, and that client has a certain amount of money, say $100,000 in the bank, here in National Bank or Republic Bank or whatever, gives you power of attorney, or that is just his for investment in the ECCU region. So he can do number three and go to sleep and come back to you 1 year later, or receive his quarterly statements and come back to you for official meeting 1 year later. So I see, so it depends on the circumstances and depends on the customers, okay?
Okay.
Thank you for that question. Okay, let's move on if there's any other. So we move to the second part of this morning's presentation. And the second part is related to customer account management. So on customer account management, we want to look at how do we operate and manage the customer's account in relation to money and banking that money? How do we operate and relate to the customer's account in terms of our accountability for the instructions he has given us, the securities we have received after trades, the securities we've sold? How do we relate to the customer? How do we manage customer's account in terms of the priority of one customer's order over another and of all customers' orders in relation to ours? We want to look at the information we give customers, and in this case, referring to the level of independence we exercise in giving them information and in using information with them from them. And we want to look at any possible conflict of interest that may arise, especially when we are undertaking discretionary activities, whether with type 1, 2, or 3 discretionary accounts, or with no discretionary accounts at all. Okay, so these are the things we will look at in the management of customer accounts. Let us look at customers' money first. Whenever we open a new account, we must make sure that funds we receive from the customer for this account. Usually, we open an account and right there the customer wants to buy. So the customer sends us money or leaves with us money. Those monies must always be, first of all, entered in our record in writing, but deposited somewhere which is only customers. So segregated. Segregate here means segregate in bank accounts, customers' funds from our firm's money, from our company's money. Never put customers' money in the same account as your money. Never put your money in customers' account funds where funds are held. That's what segregate means here. And in continuing relationship with customers, money is received for securities that you sold, and money that you are using to purchase securities. Your debits and your credits should be from the balances of the customer in your records, in your book. There should be money journals, there should be cash journals for customers' funds inside the firm. And these must be reconciled daily. Every day that you receive or spend money that belongs to customers, the books, the internal books of the company must be updated. We are going to test you on these as well, because it's extremely important that in the administration of customer accounts, you are aware and proven to be aware that customers' funds must always be segregated and separated from yours. And that inside your books, each customer's money must be represented separate from other customers' money. In your book, there should not be bulk money for the customers from Grenada all in one place. All the customers from Grenada's money must be identifiable by the individual customer always and everywhere in your books. And these must be reconciled daily. So the funds you receive from sales that took place yesterday, you receive them today because settlement took place today. When you receive them today, never mind you have not gotten your bank statement. In your own records, at the end of today, you should have those funds already represented in your books. And if you had sent them out today, you also represent that you send them to the customer's private personal account today. If not, you have them overnight today, you send them tomorrow, whatever the case may be. But in your supervisory manual, it tells you when you are to move funds, and you should record them each time as they are moved. All customers' information must be held confidential. All customers' information must be held confidential. The accountability and order priority for your transactions on behalf of customers. For all the money transactions of the firm, the supervisor, in this case, it will be your principal, the licensed principal, must authorize money and security position movements. This will always be one of the things that is reviewed by the compliance person, and it will certainly be reviewed by the regulators visiting your firm. Authorization is needed. So our representatives cannot ups and be moving securities from here to there, cannot ups and be moving money, debits and credits and so on here to there, any old house. The principal, who is a supervisor at the firm, must always authorize movements. Principal, movements of monies, movements of securities may result in change of ownership. If they are moving between accounts of the same customer, it does not. But it moves and changes the balances of the accounts of the customer. We are most concerned though with when it changes title. And all of these movements that potentially can change title, including your orders to sell, all of them must be authorized by the principal. In firms where we have both a lead principal and a compliance officer, operator, a principal operational compliance officer, the compliance officer should audit this movement. Accountability within the firm for monies and securities movement is a requirement, and that is why the records must show each movement on the day when the movement occurs. Now, we don't have plenty trades, plenty transactions taking place in some of our firms, and for this reason, people tend to bank it up and to leave it and so on. Even firms where a lot of activities take place, on one day, for example, we may have 15 transactions. Or on the day of an auction, we may have 10 clients successful. Well, 15 and 10 transactions are a few transactions. These are not plenty transactions at all. In fact, even if there were many, we would want to say that they should all be reviewed on the same day. And so if you do not even have it in Excel or some other electronic application, you still have to do it manually. Movements must be accounted for, reported on and accounted for each day when they occur. They should not be left bankrupt. Well, say, the only two we had, we looked at the end of the week. End of week reporting and recording leaves you open to the risk of incorrect information to the client between Monday and Friday, or between last week and Monday this week when you left it to be done. So those should never be left to accumulate, not even overnight. Customers' orders take preference over the firm's orders at the same price at all times. And in fact, where the customer's order is at a different price, but was received before our firm decided to place an order in the same instrument, in the same security, the customer's order must be processed first in time.
Okay. So, question, are you saying that the firm's order, comes secondary to the customer's order?
Yes.
The customer's order should always be put up first?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And if you as a representative have an order, it should be put up by another representative.
All right, that you have to put in your supervisory manual. It is best practice that the representative, you mean if I as a representative, if I am the one investing for myself?
Yes.
Right. The broker dealers, supervisory manual to speak to this. And the best practice and our recommendation on it is that every year, but some firms are doing it each time it changes, which is best practice. The firm, every member of a firm, every representative, every principal must record in the firm the personal interest in any security that is traded on the market. In addition to that, any change in that interest should be reported to the firm as well. And you are correct. This question is a good one. The best practice is that individual licensed brokers in the firm, when you have more than one broker, subject to your own internal policy, best practice, your personal should be done by other persons.
Okay,
right? And procedurally, every year you should take a record of the interest of your staff in securities that are traded on the exchange. And that is one of the books that the regulators will look for when they come. We will ask you, may I see your record of staff interest in securities?
So you're saying that it's something that has to be put up prior to the bid, or you just take a list as it happens? So if I'm a representative and I want to take part in a treasury bill that's auctioned maybe a few days from now, right? That should be noted prior to the auction, or?
Yes, best practice is that you note it prior to. You inform your principal. You also have an order form. You have to do an order form like any other client. And for you, you would have a customer file with your own company. So your customer file should have that represented on it, and your notice to your principal should also be given. Yes, that is true. And if a principal is the one that has been interested in having interest in securities and wants to do additional work, that principal reports that to his own file to the compliance officer in the firm as well, and for the purposes of disclosure also reports it even to his non-licensed manager, if there is such a thing in the firm. The key thing here is complete and total disclosure of your interest in securities, in the dealings in securities, on your personal behalf. You would have done some work on insider trading before, and one of the case studies is even going to be about insider trading, so we'll have opportunity to look at it again later.
Okay, thank you.
So just this last bullet in this slide here has two or three paragraphs on the work that we do regarding procedures, but it's extremely important that you take note of this, that the customer's orders take preference to the firm's orders, and this is for price. So if I gave you any example whatsoever, and I tell you that yesterday the board decided that it will invest in the board, I am in Baxter Broker Services. The board of Baxter Broker Services decided yesterday at their meeting, it was at 12 o'clock that meeting, that they were going to invest in the, that they were going to invest in the treasury bill tomorrow, or that they were going to purchase TDC shares. They decided on that immediately. They're going to purchase immediately. They call the rep, they do the call for a form, they write up the form and so on, and they send the form. As a representative, you record the form as being received at 10 o'clock this morning. In any case, you had been quoting another customer, and you got the other customer's thing at 5 to 10 or 9 o'clock this morning, or you found it on a fax machine this morning. Notwithstanding that your firm decided on this yesterday, and you are aware that it decided on it yesterday, you received the form from your client today. You received your board's form today. Your client's form, your customer's form takes precedence.
One more question. Okay, so if family member, if I as a representative, I'm putting up a family member order, that should be last? Asking.
A family member?
Uh-huh.
Your family member is your customer, and your customer is arm's length like everybody else. The only thing is that if you notice, when you review in detail the new customer form, you'll see, and when you review the purchase order forms, you'll see that one of the things that is there is to disclose whether your customer is related to any member of your firm. If your customer is related to any member of your firm, that is noted on the customer's file. When you receive your customer's order, you're not receiving any family member order, you're receiving a regular order from a customer like anyone else. The importance of this accountability and order priority is its relationship between the brokerage firm and its customers. So if you receive your family member order, and your family member order was received 10 o'clock, and you receive another customer's order, it was received 11 o'clock, your family member is a customer just like the other customer who you received 11 o'clock, you treat them equally. The fact that they're your family member is important for other things, like, for example, insider trading, insider information, those sort of things, but not for as far as the order priority is concerned. The order priority we're concerned with here is the order priority related to the firm's own orders and bids as compared to customers' orders and bids. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you. All right, so we move now to the independence of information we use in investment advice. When we give an investment advice, it's extremely important that the information that we use to give investment advice, or the information that we are considering with our client, that our client heard about and asking us our advice on, that this is public information, that this is factual information. It must be. It cannot be quasi-public, it cannot be quasi-factual, it must be public, it must be factual. So the information that we use to make recommendations to customers, it should not be, as an example, that we went to a very special meeting of all issuers listed on the ECSE in St. Lucia. And in that meeting, there was a little side conversation in which the Bank of St. Lucia, the ECFH, who is listed, told us something, but it is their intention. They have not yet told the public. We do not make recommendation on that information. They have not yet published it. They have not yet disclosed it. We only use information that is in the public domain. We do not give people advice based on assessment we have that I think based on the hurricane season that came, that company is changing its dividend policy. Or based on the threat from the government, that company is going to withdraw from that business. We don't know that for a fact. The company has not said so, has not decided on it. The government has taken no action against the company. That is not a fact. You might be very well informed from reliable sources, but it is not a fact. And we therefore do not take action. We do not make recommendations on those. No insider information should be used. And in your earlier session, you would have gone through what insider information is. Insider information, it is as insider could be. There are some pieces of information that is doubtful whether it is insider information. Remember, insider information, the question is not that the information comes from somebody who's inside. The question is that the information is only available because that person is a related party. It should never be used when given investment advice. Neither should it be used when determining investment strategies, when making recommendations to your clients. All investors should receive the information that we have as a brokerage firm at the same time. We are not physically saying, we are not saying the impossible, that make sure everybody hears it at the same time. Make sure everybody reads it at the same time. No. What we are saying is that any information we act on should have been published and made available to the public so that everyone has equal opportunity to receive it. So in order that you send information to some clients, all those who are in Tobago, and you don't send to those who are in St. George's. It's not that you send to all those who are currently active, and we don't send to those who have not gave us a business or a bid for the last year. It should be to all clients regardless. That's why we recommend the use of circulars. If there's information that is already in the public domain that you are aware of as a broker, that you consider should be widely reaching your customers, the ECSE's website is a prime place to ensure that it is. You contact the ECSE, you provide the information that is already public, and you ask the ECSE for sharing it on its website, on its webpage, on its news page. If it's about an issuer, on the issuer's issue profile and issuer news. So this is about independence of information. It means that whatever information that we're using must not be information that we concoct or that somebody else has actually put together and held confidentially, or somebody is aware of, or we are aware of because of our position in relation to the company's inside decision making, but it must be public. And it should not be information that is speculative, that is possibly could happen, and we took like it go in that direction, or it happened 10 years ago or 5 years ago, it go happen again, we go, no, it must be factual. To influence others, we need to use factual information. So this is about information. And conflicts of interest you will have met also in governance, as well as in conduct of business. And here, the key thing is to point out a few areas that are important. The broker's own and significant interest in the issue. Just like you asked about family member there, it's important that the broker discloses to his clients when it has an interest in it. Your interest could simply be that you are an advisor to that issuer. So if I'm an advisor as Basitea Brokers Limited, I'm an advisor to St. Kitts News Angola National Bank Limited, and I'm speaking to a client who is just seeking to do some investments, and I'm asking him about different things to get his, I'm going to know your customer process, or I'm making a recommendation regarding St. Kitts News Angola National Bank, APO, for example. I must let the customer know, and I should write there in bold type so that he can see, not in fine print, in bold type so that he can see that my firm is an advisor to this firm on whose behalf I'm now acting as a broker, and in whose APO I'm encouraging you to invest. So you need to disclose that. Okay, and these are the points here. You know, you have those slides, you know, you just run through them as summary points. We are also going to test you on this because conflict of interest is extremely important that you pay attention to what situations are those in which a broker should not be involved when advising customers and when making recommendations to customers. What constitutes an infringement because it's conflict of interest, or because it's insider trading, or because it is with information that has not been disclosed transparently. Okay, so these are some of the issues. You know, you have a recommended list, the broker, the companies on the list, you have a significant interest in the business of the issuer. For example, if that company supplies you maybe 60% of the things you use in your business, you need to know you have that relation and you demonstrate that that is the case. If that company is indeed also a big investor in yours, you need to look at in your operations, you need to look at telling them that. And if your parent company has that company as a subsidiary or has a substantial investment, more than 5% at least, in that company, you need to disclose that as well in your repertoire and your approach to investors, okay? Of interest. So let's speak about account management and record keeping. Let's speak in a little more detail. There are some things in our form that we should review daily, other things we should review weekly, some things you will want to check at least quarterly, and some things you could get away or you need to just do it to revise them annually. You'll recall I've been saying that you need an annual review of your customer file. I mean, if after a year you don't review your customer file, then there's a little way in which you will be developing business with that customer. And so we encourage that for both the business development reason, but also for the prudential reason as well. Some records you will keep at your branch, and even where you don't have branch, it means some records you keep with the representatives and other records you keep at the head office. Even if you don't have a head office separate from a branch, some records you keep where the principal has it at his fingertips and other records you keep where the representative has it at his fingertips. So for daily review, some things you have to review each day, and these are things you would want to review each day. Things like your incoming correspondence. It should be seen every day, reviewed every day, and you need to take action on it so promptly, so you need to see it every day. Market trade summaries. Trade should not happen today, and you didn't know about it today, you know about it tomorrow. Sometimes people, you know, you didn't have a trade for the last 4 months, no matches and so on, so you come to work and you don't even look at the board. Not good. End of the day, you leave and you just close up the machine, you don't look at the board. Not good. The market closes at 2. Trade summaries must be looked at by 2:05. In fact, since 5 to 2, you should know what's going on in terms of trade for the day, both in your securities, but in generally in the market. The daily purchase and sales blotter is important, and we have depository reconciliation. I mean, to know what's happening with your clients that comes in the depository. Securities increase, securities decrease, you know, you did a donation transfer, has it been completed, has it been processed, you need to look at that. The customer account forms that are done today, they should be submitted today for review by the principal. Your order tickets, orders that you place today, make sure that the orders, you review them at the end of the day, see where they are, what they're looking like. Confirmation statements, in other words, when trades take place and you confirm to a client, and the trade take place today, by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the client should have on his email or on his fax machine, should have off from your telephone call, should have a confirmation, and the confirmation statement should be given. If you turn for one moment to the supervisory manual again, let us see a sample of the confirmation statement. This is important because we want you to know what it is that you're confirming to the customer. You should confirm to the customer that the trade has taken place or not taken place. And this customer confirmation statement you will find at the back. It's already on page 71.
Yeah.
All right, page 75. You can see a confirmation statement there. Look, you have to give the guy the account number. You have to give the guy whether he bought or sold. You have to give the guy the symbol or the security symbol. And this statement is now adjusted to include the ISIN. The International Standard Identification Number, of the security. It's a very long one, I think about 12 digits, alphanumeric. So the symbol, the ISIN number, the description, if it's a 91-day T-bill, if it's equity or shares, right? All of that you have to put in there. This is a sample. In your firm, It might vary because you will have your company logo and so on. And depending on the type of security, it may vary. So if it is a derivative security, it will be different from if it is an underlying bond or something. So, but the statement must be given. You can see you should give the amount. And I wanted to notice two other things. You should note, you should see that you have the commission. Commission and fee should be stated. You should actually, in your statement, tell the customer what is your charge for this transaction that you are confirming to him that has taken place. All right? So this is a sample of the form, and you really will do well just to go through it and make sure, because it is saying what is the amount that is confirmed. At the bottom it says among due. You can see among due there, because if it's a discretionary account, you are now then going to debit the client's account if it was a buy, because you need settlement in the morning. And that's why these statements must be reviewed every single day. And this is a confirmation statement you give to him by the end of the day, because you must tell him whether you have a discretionary account or not. You tell him, I'm going to use your money now for this. Okay, so that he knows at the end of the day that this money is no longer his because of the trade. It belongs to somebody else. The settlement is on T+1 on the following day. Okay. So this is a sample of the statement that you have there in the intermediary manual. Let's go back now to the slide once again. You see public communication. Any public communication that the brokerage firm issues, on the day that it issues it, it needs to check it back and make sure that which went out is what you wanted to go out. You know, a lot of mistakes happen and so, yeah. So you want to make sure that, not to tell in all good intention that you didn't send out something that you shouldn't, or you want to make sure at the end of the day that it did go out because it needed to go out. Maybe it's a disclosure on something of your own firm, or it's something that your client who's an issuer gave you to send out. You don't want to leave it too long at the end of every day. And for every public communication that you issue, and for every complaint that the firm receives, on the day that it is received, you need to forward a copy to the compliance manager. So if it's the principal who's responsible for compliance of the firm, you send it to him. If you have a separate compliance manager who is not really a principal, but he does compliance and advises the principal, then that person, you send it to him as well, and he will send it back to the principal. These are the things that we review on a daily basis. Please take note of them. Weekly, on a weekly basis, the principal and the compliance manager needs to review what the representative would have done, but at random. You don't need to review every single thing, but you need to review sufficient to give you a feel for what has happened in the last week. You're looking for things like unsuitable recommendations, things that are outside of the objectives. You're looking for things that where your representative is operating on a FAD, you know, or whether he's just seeking to boost his commissions or something like that. So these are the things that you look for. Any unauthorized transaction, any order that was put in there that the principal didn't sign off on, you're looking for that to make sure that nothing untoward has happened. And improper commissions have not been charged, no markup has been given. And you're looking for the correspondence related to trade, that a statement confirming transactions have been sent out, and so forth. Any other prohibited practices, as you would have discussed in the previous presentations. On a monthly basis, you want to look at a summary of report of all commission states. And even for the firms that do not pay commission because your staff work on a fixed salary, you want to look at the commission that would have been charged to the client for each of the individuals. Because each of the individuals' performance is still tied towards the bonus at the end of the year and so on. You want to look at that from as early as every month while it's going, so that you don't end up discovering something off-key or untoward when the client complains in a year's time. You look for the monthly account reconciliation that should have been done. Customers' funds must be reconciled, as I said. At the end of every day, there should be an entry, and at least monthly, there should be a reconciliation of customers' funds. And that reconciliation, ECSE would not be asking you for it. The commission is not asking for it. You should have it. You need it. And it would be reviewed indeed when we are doing our compliance visits. The inventory of securities, this is very important. Inventory of security should not be reviewed every month because we say to review it. It should be reviewed because these are assets of your own company and assets of clients that you have. Your own company's assets should be segregated from the assets you hold on behalf of clients. And that's why we say the inventory of security should be reviewed every month, the own and the nominee. The nominee should be those accounts in which you are holding securities in client's name. And so the detailed review of that would be to look at the statement or the log of detailed log of client's holdings in that nominee account in each of the instruments in that account. Looking now at the quarterly, just a few things needed for quarterly review. You want to look at client's account statements, make sure that statements were sent out to clients and that these statements are true to results of transactions and none was missed and that the clients would have acknowledged them. In some cases, that is also very important. And the personal accounts of agents and staff. In this case, someone asked a question about family members a while ago, and quarterly you could also review the accounts of persons who are your customers who are relatives of your staff members. Okay? I didn't put it here because you do not really need to discriminate against family members or staff members who are having family members as customers of the firm. But you do need to keep an eye on it, especially on a quarterly basis, to ensure that there is nothing that is happening out of the rule, out of the law, and out of the practices of the firm, right? So, but on a quarterly basis, you review all those accounts. On an annual basis, for sure, you want to look at the compliance manager or the lead principal, at least. You want to examine the branches and the representatives' portfolios. Now, this is not only the personal portfolios, but more so the business portfolio. I mean, on a yearly basis, you want to see the client that a representative is servicing. Because if the firm has 1,000 clients and the representative is only serving 100, something is wrong. And there will be no development of your company's business. And in addition to that, there will be no development of the market as such. If your firm has only 100 clients and your representative is servicing that 100 client, maybe your representative is in a marking time status and is only doing 100 because you are satisfied with 100 and you are paying him or her a flat fee for 100. Why should I go out and look for anything more? If they come, they come. And so on an annual basis, you want to review when you're doing your annual budget, your annual projections, and your annual compliance review and your performance review of you know, what your brokerage operations is doing. Then you want to see what the representative portfolios are, how many clients, what volume of business, how many orders, things like that. You want to review those annually. And you want to make a sign of approval of what's going on there or a sign of confirmation that, listen, we have to do something different. Examination visits, if you are actually having branches, then on a yearly basis you do visit for the purpose of reviewing compliance procedures, especially procedures review, and compliance with them is extremely important. So this takes us all the way into where the records are kept. And very quickly, I'd just like to go through these and leave these for you. We will ask you a few questions about this maybe one question about this, because we want to know that you are aware where things should be kept. The thing about it is that you should not walk into a firm, or the ECSE should not call a firm, or the commission should not call a firm, or an investor should not call his brokerage firm and ask for something, and you tell him, all right, I'll call you back in an hour, because you have to go and search for that thing someplace. Certain things must be at the fingertips, and other things can be in safekeeping elsewhere. Certain things must be with the principal, and he should be able to say, let me check and see, and look at it right away. Other things can be elsewhere. Your manual, for sure, you need to have on your desk. All of your manuals, your manuals for the systems, and your supervisory operations manual, and your CSD participant manual, those you should have at your desk. But these are the things that should be kept at the branch. And when I say branch here, this could be for small firms, meaning the desk of the op, or the cabinets of the op, of the representatives. The trade blotter, which records all trades. The cash blotter, which records all cash that is coming in and all cash that we're paying out, whether through the CSD or directly back to the client. And the client file contains the client's related information. You could have a copy of the client, of some parts of the client file with the representative, and you can have the substantial client file back with the principal. That's not a problem. But some elements of the client file belong right there with the representative. Because he who has a call, even though a business has come up within his scheduled time for calling or writing, as the case may be, and he who has to send it to the correct person. then the complaint file should be with the supervisor's review notes present with the branch, because it is the supervisor's review notes that tells you what to do to correct what has happened before. And any complaint file. This complaint is a big thing because people call and they complain. You need to log the complaint and you need to log the action taken for the complaint. This should be on the supervisor's desk, even though in fact it belongs to the principal to review, to approve the action taken or to recommend the action taken and to ensure that it is done. And the correspondence and advertising file should be at the branch from where it is done, with the approved advertisements and correspondence from where it is disbursed or disseminated. This is very, very important that it be with the representatives. And at the head office, finally, at the head office, we need to keep certain important things. We need to keep that which shows the bids and the ask for customers, and this is grouped. This can be sent there every month, it can be sent there every quarter, but those order tickets that have been executed and are completed should be with the archive or with the head office. The details of buy and sell order from each day over a period, it should be there. These can be physical files, they can be electronic files as well, but even if they're electronic files, they must be PDF with a signature of the client, because you know these are all audit trail records. And the records of securities entries, so any stock record, I mean the bond record, or whatever it is, should be with the head office. And the cash blotter. This is the record of which journalizes all the monies that have moved from one to another. And in addition to that, the firm's ledger that shows assets and liabilities, that needs to be at the head office. Your net capital computation, that is your net capital with which you operate in your brokerage firm, you should have those computations with you at the head office so that you at any time are on top of your exposures and your substantive capabilities or capacity to carry the business volumes that you are carrying. And the customer's account. The new customer account forms should be held somewhere, the originals with the securities, somewhere at head office. So that is about managing the firm's operations, and I would like to conclude with a few remarks on some supporting internal structures that are critical for the firm's success. Number one, operating manuals, key, because the operating manuals provide direction to staff. The supervisor doesn't have to be there every day, the commission doesn't have to be there every day, the TCSC doesn't have to be there every day, that's why we have manuals, so you can pick it up and know what to do next. Representatives and principals should not be calling the ECSC and be calling the commission every day for everything. The manuals have it. Please use the manual. This manual governs everything. And anything in the manual that is not there, you need to come back to the ECSC, come back to the commission, perhaps for assistance to see, let us see how we could boost this manual recommendation that you have for us. The front and the back office operations are directed by these manuals. A lot of time is wasted if we are not using the manuals, or if something we should have in the manuals, something is not in the manual. So one day we do it one way, and next day we do it the other way. That's why we need to have very strong manuals. And that's why the supervisory manuals are approved by the commission. They are looked at, especially the operation manual, by the ECSE, and we make sure that they are in conformity. For those of you who are now becoming certified brokers, you have an advantage because you are dealing only with the new system and the new manuals that we have developed for operations in the new applications, the Munchon CSV and the Munchon trading system. Your manual should always indicate the type of business you're in. You know, we have limited service brokers, we have investment advisors, and we have full service brokers, broker dealers. And so the manual should be very clear what operations you're in, and the brokers are expected to be operating at that full level of the business firm's operations. And we always file our manuals with the regulator. So if, for example, you made a change to your manual regarding something that you realize was not properly done or processed at your firm, or you discover that you need to put some additional points on it, you need to resubmit that section of your manual to the commission and to the ECSE for review and acceptance. The operation manual. Now, supporting structure in supporting internal structures. How do we treat complaints? Complaints from customers are such that we need to make sure that we have a procedure for promptly addressing them. The procedure for promptly addressing customers' complaints may be included in your supervisory manual or in a separate compliance manual or in a policy document only dealing with complaints. However it is, it should be looking at how we address them promptly, how we can receive them. Some complaints will be received by phone, some complaints will be received by writing, some complaints will be received through walk-ins, visits to our firms. What do we do when the complainant comes in and is with the representative? What is the procedure? Should he call the principal? Should he refer it to the principal? If it's about him, should we refer it to another representative? What is the procedure for that? That should also be established. That's an internal structure in the company, internal arrangement that you must do in order to achieve success. How should we respond? The ECSE, we recommend a response to complaint should always be in writing. And when do you write, who writes, who signs off on what is written, is an internal procedural structure that you need to put in place. And within what period should you respond on complaints? That is extremely important for the firm. Once you are responding to complaint, once you have received complaint of a significant nature, you need to ensure that they are processed and they are progressed satisfactorily. But more importantly, the customer must be notified in best practice. The customer must be notified that this is the progress we've made until you arrive to some conclusion and the customer is satisfied. An unhappy customer is a loss of business. We should take corrective action to avoid reoccurrence. So the corrective action should not be at all penal corrective action against whoever was involved and that sort of thing. It should be primarily to avoid a reoccurrence of whatever the person is complaining about. Even if something wrong didn't happen, we avoid reoccurrence of anything which will give the perception that wrong has happened. Whatever it is, we need to address it. And once done, notify the ECSE if the ECSE has requested. Notify the commission if the commission became aware and has requested. Once the ECSE and the commission calls, do not take up a defensive role or approach or posture. Just respond and just answer. Customer confidentiality, extremely important. The confidentiality is not only by the firm. It is by the intermediary group, which is your principal, your representative, and it's by all other personnel, even the one who sends out the fax for us because that's a back office person. Even the one who staples the documents for us, we need confidentiality from everyone because the business of our customer is a business that he brought to us. Confidentially, they must be kept there and nowhere else. We should hold confidential the securities in his portfolio, the investment strategies we've discussed with him or that he has given to us, the money balance that he has, nobody has to know that, but you, the firm, and him. The future investments being considered, anything you're thinking about, is not something that we can casually be telling somebody, you know, I had another customer this morning, that person outside saw that customer leave. Everything must be totally and fully confidential in our relation with customers. Every single thing. Complaints that one customer brings, if it's against another customer, it's against ourselves. Even these complaints and the complaint file must be treated. It must be shared with the ECSE and the commission on request or on your discretion that it is sufficiently serious to let us know of with the action you've taken. Confirmation statements from customers should not be left along line for the cleaners and for the janitors. It should be totally and fully confidential. And therefore, all of these things must be held in safekeeping. These are internal structures that you need to support your business in order to be successful. Your supervision of the business activities, develop your procedures manual all the time. If there is something that you realize is not in there and that should be enhanced, work on it, submit it as an amendment, get it approved. Follow the procedures in all of the work that you do. Do not rely on a telephone call to Ms. Brum or Ms. Nero or Ms. Faisal. Do not rely on these. Work with your procedures manual. Supervision of functions with audit trail. Everything you do, there should be a record of it kept somewhere. Ensure that record is there and that you know what that record is and that you put it where it belongs. The principals of the firms, you are responsible for approving all aspects of the work. all aspects of the work. Principals say, go ahead, man, you know how to do this. That is not really on. You are responsible for approving. Yes, I approve. Please proceed. Here is my signature. Here is my initial. Give me the sheet. Give me the form. I will approve it. Send me the email. I will send you back the approval in writing. Separation of duties is important. We don't have one person do everything. The Securities Act separates the roles and separates the licenses for representatives as for principals. One supervises the activity, the other level implements the activities. Keep these roles separated, the related duties are separated, and let them function accordingly. Subject to the audit by the regulators, you find things like the procedures, the customer documents. These are the things that the regulators look for. Keep these slides, look at them, and have them present in your mind and your knowledge as to what is needed. And finally, compliance. So compliance, your surveillance manual includes all compliance issues. Some firms' surveillance manual, surveillance requirements are within the intermediary supervisory manual as they have developed it. If you already belong to a firm with a active brokerage operations, check the intermediary manual, see where it has surveillance or compliance issues, and see what are the points there. It is based always on the ECSE and the ECSRC's rules. It's based on the regulations and the Securities Act, and it will be also be based on some of the internal procedures that your company has for its general operations. So some things may not be securities related to, but they are compliance on other things, and so they will be in that manual as well. But we concerned with surveillance manual for securities business. How to open new accounts, what to do, when to start business, when can you post a bid, what should you do when you receive funds from sales, should you receive funds from sales to yourself at all, things like that, and what time of the day should you transfer monies to the customer's account, and things like that. And your surveillance manual will also have information regarding potential abuses, which you would have dealt with quite a bit. So we lost a few minutes at the start, and we gained a few minutes at the end. Because 11 o'clock we were supposed to break, and before 11 o'clock we were to take some questions and answers. We had some questions during the presentation. I would like at this stage to ask if there are any questions. Okay. If not, we'll do the two case studies in the after break period. And the case studies are two interesting cases. We've used them a few times before. What we want to look at is the Know Your Customer process. And this case study number one is about investment advice. However, it is about giving advice on the basis of how well you know your customer. So what we want to do is to come back, orient the case study for investment advice, and then we take a few minutes and work through it. We'll do it together since we are online here. There's a way in which we do group study, so I'll guide the discussion on the case study after we would have read it, but maybe you may have read it before, but we'll spend a few minutes on that. We have 1 hour when we come back to work on that. With the second case study, which is insider trading and other market abuses. On the insider trading and other market abuses, that's quite an entertaining case study, and we would want to take about 15 minutes discussing some issues that we can spot there. And the key thing of these two case studies is to help us to get a grasp for some of the things that are in the, that I pointed you to in the Know Your Customer process and in the investment advisory process, and that you would have gone through both on the conduct of business segment and on the account management, customer account management section of this morning's workshop, right? So that's what the case study is about this evening. Having oriented it, we'll come back straight to it when we get back in 15 minutes time. So Ms. Faisal, Commission, you there to agree with us on the break?
Yes, Mr. Francis.
Is it 11:20?
It's 15 minutes, yes. So 11:20 back.
Thank you very much. See you all at 11:20.
Okay. Don't forget to pause the recording.
Did I remember to start it?
Yes, it's recording.
Okay, I think we can resume. And let me share the case study one. Case study one has two investors, Joseph Perkins and Mary Liebert. The theme is investment advice, and it is part of the Know Your Customer process in which we are going to determine this advice. Remember we said that Know Your Customer process has the initial stage, but it should be for renewal, and also it's continuous on an annual basis renewal, but continuous in terms of assessment as you progress with the client. So let me first of all make sure, what are we seeing on the screen? Are you seeing my screen with a case study?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And then let's make sure we're recording as well. Okay. So let's do it this way. We're going to have how many of us here today? So there are 7 of us. We're going to have 1, 2, 3. All right. So 3 of us would look at the Perkins, and 3 of us will look at the Liebert, and then even though all of us would have read both, but we'll explain to each other why we provide that advice for each of them. In each of their case studies, you'll see that in each of the cases, you'll see that some background is given saying who the person is and so on. This you would have captured somewhere in the information on the individual. And the investment horizon, we looking at determining whether it's long or short. The investment objective, we looking to determine, you know, whether it's education, retirement, combination, whatever it is. And the risk tolerance, we're looking to see how feasible it is to consider that this person can afford not to receive income growth, not to receive asset growth, not to receive income, or not to receive back part or all of the principal at all. When investing. And then we look at the previous investment history to determine what sort of strategy, what sort of understanding of a strategy we give that this client will have. And we look at personal history to determine what other factors should be used in assessing what kind of financial instruments we can suggest. Look at the earnings to know what's possible for continuous investment, future investment, what's possible for sustenance, even if you put aside whatever money they spoke about here for investment, and look at net worth, so that's what assets are held at this time, looking especially at liquid or physical, that the liquid those that need to be used on right now, and then see what other retirement benefits there might be for the future of this person, relate that back to the horizon, and to the risk tolerance, as we said. So I think we have with us Martin, Green, Lewis. We have Ms. Pemberton, Richardson, Mr. Horn, and Ms. Anthony. So Payne, Green, Lewis, please look at the first one. Pemberton, Richardson, Horn, and Suzette Anthony, please look at Liebert.
Excuse me, can you let me know which one I have to go through? I was not at my desk for a little bit.
Okay. Sorry,
That's
look.
Green.
Green?
Yes.
Okay, Green, let's do Joseph.
Okay, cool.
Let's do Joseph Perkins.
Okay.
Not to be confused, am I doing the case that's on the screen now or the other case?
No, you will do the other one, which is this one on the screen now, Liebert. So, and again, what we're trying to do is see what investment strategy and investment advice would you give for this person and what securities you will select for their investment. Why? In terms of the Know Your Customer process, how are we determining or ascertaining the factors that go into investment advisory services? In other words, what do we assess? How do we assess the investment horizon? Long, short, medium, whatever. Investment objective, what do we think should be considered with that investment objective? What seems to be? And that's the way we go all the way through. Use the personal history, use the salaries and so on, which you would have gotten on the form as well. Use the assets held as net worth and use the benefits expected during retirement based on where they are now to determine, this investment strategy, we could call it a long one, risk horizon, risk tolerance, that, and so on. And we suggest they can do this type of securities. They can do this type of investment. They can do some shares. They can do some bonds. They can do some commercial paper from companies, whatever we think is suitable.
Understood. Thanks.
Okay, so we discussed that in, about 5 minutes. And that's the same for Perkins, it's the same for each case. Okay, let's see if we could take a quick look at each of these and spot the key elements of the investment advisory process that are thrown out of the scenarios. So first, in a very general way, we could ask our first team of persons to, you would not have worked together. I don't know if you shared the chat any comments, but we could ask any one of you, Payne, Green, Lewis, tell us what you are seeing with the scenario we have here and the kind of advice, therefore, that you can give regarding strategy and instruments in which this person can invest. Payne, Green, Lewis, the floor to you.
Okay. Well, Joseph Perkins is fairly young, I mean, 35 years old. He has 30 years to retirement. There's a lot of stuff to consider, but I'm thinking his investment horizon would be suited for high to moderate. You hearing me?
Yes, I
am. Okay. I have a lot of traffic in the background. High to moderate initially, I guess, in his earlier years, probably 35 to 45. And as he gets older, I think he should decrease decrease his level of risk by investing in less riskier products. Initially, I think his investment strategy would be for long-term investment. Also, he would want to save for retirement. But I would recommend initially, as I said, from 35 probably to 45 or 50, stocks, US stocks, bonds, but a diversification in his portfolio, maybe some mutual funds. His savings, I realized that he has a savings of 100,000 US. I was thinking maybe he could take half of that and invest in maybe a repurchase agreement yearly, and the interest probably he can take and put towards decreasing his mortgage. I didn't think about it. That's basically my thought.
Okay, personal education, you're saying, for himself?
Excuse me?
The increase of his education, you said, his knowledge?
No, to decrease on his mortgage.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Decrease on the mortgage. Okay.
Yeah.
I see what you mean. So have like a prepayment or some early decrease.
Yeah. Because he has a savings of 100,000 US. I think he could invest half of that in a short-term investment, probably a repurchase agreement, a note, a treasury note, something.
Okay, that's interesting. And we have any other comments from the other two of you?
Okay, well, generally it's within the same, or basically the same thing Ms. Lewis said.
Mm-hmm.
He's young, so his risk would be probably high to moderate, though he's a single. One thing we have to look at, his wife is at home and doesn't work, so probably we should not invest all of the money that he has, leave some aside so that he'll be able to use in case he has some situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I would offer him, since he's young, bonds, long-term bonds with attractive rates, and some stocks, basically along the same lines.
Okay. Anything else? Anything else from our third reviewer?
Basically all what they said, I do agree with it. As they said, he's pretty young, so he has a length of time to invest in. But basically all what they said together would be a good advice to give to him.
Okay, I have a few questions still. How important is his personal history there? Let's look at his personal history again.
It is important because he's very green when it comes to investing, what I see. So we would have to find out, well, I guess we realize his risk tolerance. Does it say? I can't remember. I don't think it says. We would need to find out whether, since he's young, as we said, whether he would want to invest in stocks, bonds, which is what they recommend for him. Because he may be risk averse. But his knowledge of investing is very important because he would need to know what he's getting into or what we're recommending for him. He would at least need to have some basic knowledge of what we're recommending to him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The fact that he has no other retirement benefits.
Oh, yes. I was thinking he should opt for contributing, well, that's my opinion, 6% more.
Mm-hmm.
To his, because $300 is.
Okay. He should top up this. And in your investment strategy, this should be related, the retirement. The retirement benefits opportunity that he has outside of any investing that we could advise him on at all. So instead of buying any securities, he has an opportunity right here. So we need to relate that also to this other one here. The personal history where his children, what's important is knowing that the children are 6 and 10. Helps us to calculate when they may be needing
funds,
Yeah.
In terms of the investment.
Right.
So let's say you recommended a US bond, if it's 6 years, 10 years, 15 years, you need to know the
principal come into fruit.
Right.
Will come to fruit in that kind of time, yeah?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is this a lot of information about dependency, because he has two children and he has a wife who is also needed in terms of income, his own income, right? She's a stay at home for the time. It doesn't mean she'd be staying at home after the children go to college. But for the time being, she's staying at home. So I mean, his income is running the household, yeah?
Yes, it is.
But these are his dependents. You would want to put this on your form as well, and you want to take into consideration when you advising him.
Okay, noted.
So his risk tolerance, although he is young. Sorry, his investment horizon, although he is young, you can see that the fact that these kids are already 10 years doesn't really tell us that he has a long investment horizon per se, huh? Because a portion of his funds should relate to the time in which this may be maybe something he needs, huh?
Yes.
Right. Okay, then I come to one other question in terms of the, well, it shows up more in the next one, but next scenario. But in terms of liquid monies, how do you see him needing to have some funds around for emergency? I think, was it Lewis or Payne mentioned it?
Yes, he does have a savings of $100,000. I guess, given the amount of dependence he has, that is sufficient. It should be sufficient. I'm not sure. I was suggesting maybe that he put some of it into another investment, probably a short-term investment.
Okay, are you in any way familiar with any of the anyone, not only the three of you now, all everyone present? Are you in any way familiar with any of the securities, say the listed companies on the ECSE and the government that issue treasury bills and bonds? Are you sufficiently familiar to be able to say to this person you would suggest to include any of these in their portfolio?
Yes. I am familiar with it. Maybe a 90-day treasury bill or 180-day, later.
Mm-hmm.
If you they close that high enough rate.
Yeah. Okay. Let's spend a few minutes on the other case now, and then we'll wrap up towards the final one. The next scenario, this will now be Liebert, right? So for Liebert, we have Pemberton, Horn, and Tony Richardson. Let's see from you what are your thoughts on the rationale for your investment strategy and the kind of securities you would suggest. So we start with, who's starting?
Well, I guess I'll take a stab at it.
Yes, Sean, go ahead.
So Ms. Liebert has 10 years to retire and about 8 to 12 years before her children go off to college. Based on the information that was provided, she has a moderate to low risk tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm suggesting is 80-10-10 splits.
Mm-hmm.
80 in government securities, which I don't want to say are risk-free, but they are less risky than other investments.
Okay.
10 in equities, just so she could have a little bit of diversification, and keep 10 as cash, basically.
Uh-huh.
While they didn't list the expenses that she has an income of $60,000 per year, which will give her approximately $600,000 over the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Her net worth is $400,000, and she has $100,000 in the bank, which I'm assuming would be the amount that she would use to invest. She has $200,000 from her home from her mother. Or deceased mom. So just to go back to it, I would recommend that she invest in government securities heavily because she's very risk averse.
Mm-hmm.
It said that she has 2 grown children. I'm not sure if I would list them as dependents because it didn't say if they were working or not. But she's investing for her 2 grandchildren in the 8 to 12 years. Her husband is retired. It didn't say whether he has an income or not. And it also said that she'll be receiving $100,000 at the end. So what I can say, from my limited knowledge, is that she doesn't necessarily need funds right away. Maybe she could invest in some zero coupon bonds and so on that would pay that amount at the end. That's basically it. That's my stab at it.
Okay. All right, good. Any additional comments Who is Pemberton?
What he has just said, she has about 10 years to plan for retirement and on average the same amount of time to establish the required amount of funds for her grandchildren's college fund. And as he said, it states here that her husband is retired, and so I'm not sure if he would be able to help out a lot in regards to that. So I would say that she is risk averse. And so I would recommend for her to invest mainly in government notes and bonds with some equities thrown in there.
Okay, so you coincide on the risk averse part, and yeah. Okay, but you still give her some equities, you said?
Yes.
Okay. All right, Richardson, any comments additional?
Yes, I agree to what both Mr. Horn and Pemberton said. She has a limited number of years to retirement and also has a high net worth of assets. So for her, it would be best if she invests in treasury bills and stock. She has a low to medium horizon, investment horizon.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they didn't mention the dynamics of the store she owns, but if she's to pass on, I assume the store would be passed on to her children. She has two children, and that store can be used to fund future investments.
Mm-hmm.
So for her, she doesn't necessarily need to invest in high or long-term securities. Yeah, that's basically it.
Okay. All right. And finally, Ms. Anthony, any comments?
Not much. Basically, what everybody else said, I agree with. It also indicates that she has some level of knowledge in regards to the technology stock that she does invest in online. The only thing I would say is, in terms of having cash, I guess it's important for her to have that sense that her husband is retired. She's also not very far from retirement. So for whatever possible major medical situation or emergency that they may have, especially given that we're not told what level of funding the husband receives.
Okay. Okay, very good. I think I think all those are good reasons for what you're recommending. Particularly like the fact that Horn, you tried to give a percentage in which you would divide her investments. So you're actually right there trying to build a portfolio with an investment strategy based on her horizon and so on that you have assessed. And risk tolerance that you would have assessed. How important is this little piece here that she has made a few investments online in technology stocks? I mean, up to $30,000 based on she has a salary of $60,000 per year and so on, and she has made this investment. That for some people is a lot of experience, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yes, I
agree.
And she may have done this not on speaking to any qualified, certified brokers like yourselves. Maybe she might have been just following some advice or some friend. Huh? She's a teacher. She must have been reading quite a bit and must have been in contact with people sufficiently.
Well, I also said she has a cousin
who
has considered interest in a listed company.
Right. Okay. Okay. So you see.
That could be her sort of advice.
Right. So the level of advice may have been, yes, that's correct. But also in terms of what she has, in terms of net worth and where it is in physical assets, there's two houses. And so Would you think that she would be better classified as being an income rather than a retirement objective person?
That depends on her, the level of expenses that they have.
Because she has
a salary of 60,000. Maybe that 60,000 can cover majority of the expenses. But right. I think that expenses portion is missing for us to make a true judgment.
Yeah. So it's here, and then the husband being she's retired. Is the husband retired?
Yes, he is. The husband's retired, she's not retired as well.
Right. So from our investments, you may want to be having supplemental income for them. The retirement seems to be taken care of up to 100 million or so to be able to help them through with their current things and for preparing the grandchildren. But these are quite grandchildren, not really children. So you might think a lesser obligation in that sense. So in that way, income support might have a greater weight than retirement planning at this time. Even legacy may have a greater, or inheritance for the grandchildren maybe. Because it actually says that she would like to participate in that, the investor's concern about the college education. Okay, so in general, that gives a good feel. I think you appreciate and understand well what we have done here. So you remember the Know Your Customer process and the investment advisory process. It is a process. That is exactly what it is. And it's not like thinking about what is on the market. It's in the first place thinking about what the customer situation is. And then we determine based on our market analysis and our risk assessment what is suited to the customer. We take into consideration not just what the customer tell us, but also what we can glean and assess from what we have them write on the form as their income, as their whether they're married or not married, things like that. So we have to have that rounded thing. So for example, if you were to be asked about the what is important in the provision of advice to a customer, and you see age there, you will know why you will include age as a yes. You know, because maybe I might have the investment history, we might have the relationship with the boss, you know, we might have all kind of funny things. And in the end, you have to choose two. Well, age will be important because it relates to the investment horizon. You know, so that's what we wanted to make sure is that you understand the reasoning behind our use of the information in building the strategic investment advice to the client and in getting something suited for the client or not. Long-term things might have higher rate, but it depends on does the time exist. Higher rate might be good to get income, but in return it conflicts with whether or not it is risky and the client cannot afford or has a low risk tolerance, cannot afford to lose. All right, any questions as we leave this one? Okay, if not, let's read this. Sorry, there's a question.
Oh, in relation to Mary's case, could we recommend for her to have one of the houses rented? Is that an option?
Recommend to have, beg your pardon, can you repeat, please?
Could we recommend for her to have one of the houses rented?
I could see it saying yes, I could say yes. I could say yes, because what this is that it's an asset as well, and if she doesn't have to use it, then it is an income earner. Likewise, it is a kind of asset as well. You know, somewhere down the road she can convert into cash through sale. So when it is not needed to be converted into cash, she's under no pressure. It seems then put the mom's house to productive use by bringing in some income. Yes, so I would think yes. Okay. All right. And maybe just one last comment. Someone had mentioned the Treasury bill thing. So the short-term instruments like the Treasury bills, and so they have the two advantages. They have the advantage, number one, is that it is more predictable, easier to predict that the government will not go broke in 3 months. I will get back my Treasury bill money than a long-term bond. So you have that relative certainty, I would say. Not even the word certainty is even hard to get out of my mouth, but you are more assured, can be more assured that in 3 months you'll get back the principal than in 10 years. And then there's a second thing is that it's liquid, it's liquidity. It means you always have the money nearby. Even if something happened in 2 months' time, you just wait one more month and you get the money back. The income from it, you also, if you have your income, the treasury bills are discount, but at least you get your benefit in the principal value being more than what you paid, and you get that in 3 months. So you have those two elements. So the liquidity, even when we say we want to be liquid, sometimes when we assess, we say, okay, well, you should keep some in the bank. Well, yes, you can keep some in the bank, but that still would not does not mean that if you have it in a treasury bill, it is not liquid. Short terms are also considered of greater liquidity than long term, so you have that advantage as well. Okay, so let's move on to the insider trading case. And the insider trading case, we will all together take a read of it. Let me see, we have some questions at the end of it. So the first team, we'll ask you to do the first three questions, and then Lewis, Pemberton, and Richardson, you should do the next three questions, and then Horner, Anthony, you will take the rest. Let me see if I can get the presentation up. Okay, so we're going 369. The first three questions here, 1, 2, 3. Payne, Green, and Lewis, those are for you. 4, 5, 6. Pemberton and Richardson, those are for you. 7 and 8. Actually, 7, 8, and 9. Horn and Anthony, those are for you. Clear? Clear, everyone?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so let's just read through, take a 5 minutes, read through the case and come back. Okay. Shall we go? This case, first and foremost, was treated as a case, huh? In its own self, it's a case already. So, Ms. Payne, Ms. Green, the word conduct comes up here so many times. The case reminds you of the session on conduct of business. Perhaps also on governance, the corporate governance session. And also in the the customer account management. So who has benefited from the conduct described in this case? Do I hear some participation?
Blake?
Blake and her family have benefited?
Fleming and all the customers.
Can I ask you a supporting question? Because this case is dealing with some wrongdoing some way or the other.
Uh-huh.
Is it so that everyone who benefits from a conduct would have committed a wrong?
Yes.
Not all, because all of them were not aware. She just told them to sell.
Hmm.
Material information.
Okay. So, but from your thoughts, from your thinking, are we concerned with who benefited and are tied to the conduct that they did it and they benefited? Or are we concerned with who benefited period, or are we just concerned with whose conduct was not correct?
The conduct that was not correct.
And also the benefit, who has benefited by the conduct?
Yes, I'm asking a supporting question.
Mm-hmm.
A supporting question, yeah. Are we focusing here on the benefit? Are we focusing on the conduct? Are we focusing on those who benefited because of the conduct that they did?
Because of the conduct.
The conduct. Both of them.
Right. Okay. This is the important point, and I want to bring us on the question. The question is who benefited. Yes, but from our point of view, we are training for brokers. The question is here really and truly. The underlying question is the conduct of a person resulted in that person's benefiting. Even though others benefited without the conduct, it is the conduct that is wrong, eh?
Yeah.
The target problem here is on the conduct. The problem is on the conduct of the people, where it is wrong. So you say who benefited? Blake? The whole family? Anybody else besides Blake and the family?
Well, that's the book.
Fleming.
Yes.
Fleming.
What about a friend?
Fleming, my friend.
What about Watkins?
Her friend.
The broker.
Watkins?
He looked like he's in a lot of trouble. He looked like he benefited. But the point is, he did not perpetuate the conduct, did he? That's a question.
Watkins was a customer.
Because he has a bigger friend. Yes, what gives us the customer? Small customer. Well, okay, just on the first question alone, can we just, we say Blake and her family, let us call the other persons that are in there and in terms of benefit, determine whether they benefited. The father, the mother, the sister, and so on. What about a friend, not sick, Norma, no, Norma.
Norma, yes.
Yeah. Norma. Norma, the astute businesswoman.
She benefited as well.
She benefits, right?
Yes.
Okay, so we'll come back to her in a while and see in relation to conduct what's happening there. Then we go to we mentioned Watkins a while ago. Watkins is a customer. The Watkins benefit?
No.
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 Now we look at him and we look at Watkins in terms of conduct in a while. What about Vena?
Does not benefit.
Okay, stay in that same paragraph. Does Vena have more information than Watkins?
Yes. Selling this clothes.
Yes, he has more information. Vena has more information.
Okay, if we take it by what is written here, Vena has more information because Vena knows that is a theft and so on.
Yes.
Watkins just knows something went wrong, eh?
Right.
Okay. We come back to them in terms of the conduct and then Vena takes a certain action. He does not, right? He does not sell.
Yes, he doesn't sell.
Watkins sells, yeah?
Yes.
Okay. So let's go to the second question now. Who has been harmed by the conduct? Ms. Green?
I would say the business to a certain extent. The business. Primarily, well, whoever else was forming part of the business.
Are you including the father and the mother and them and all that?
No.
No, okay. Just the other persons who were also who are also depending on Blake's leadership. The other shareholders.
Okay, yes.
Okay. All right, everybody agree? Any other comments? So let's now go to the third question now. Potential violations of the Securities Act in this case. So for everyone we're going to call as potential violations. Here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Pemberton, if you make a list and say who is violating there. So So, Louis, what are the potential violations?
Insider trading.
Insider trading is one. So let's put a list and see who is committing insider trading here now, Pemberton.
Blake,
obviously, we talked about here, Blake.
The family members that traded.
Norma. Blake, who again?
The family members.
Okay, can we...
Colin.
Can we say all the family members? Are we okay to say that?
The father, the brother, the sister, and the uncle.
Uh-huh.
I would say all those who would have sold because of receiving that information prior to the general public knowing that anything was wrong.
Okay. Right there, I want to ask you now about Norma. I want to take this opportunity to ask about Norma, because Blake told all these people the details, the father, the mother, and so on. So they are acting on insider information, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Then he told Norma now, without disclosing any of the details of the theft. So does Norma have insider information?
She not does. Directly.
No.
Yes, she does.
She has it, but she doesn't use it indirectly. She does not disclose it.
Who, Norma? So she tells Norma, let's go again. Blake calls her friend Norma without disclosing any of the details. But she frantically and emphatically urges to sell her time stock. So Norma, being an astute businessman, this is the point here. This is the point here. Norma is like you meet an investor who is what we call sophisticated investor. That was defined for you in an earlier session. So who are sophisticated investors? Investors who are aware of the market, they are aware of the industry, that kind of thing, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. They're familiar with owning stocks and so on. So Norma is one of those. She's an astute businessman. She suspects something catastrophic has, even if we didn't get that sentence, that she suspects something catastrophic. Look at this. The president calls her, who is her friend, by the way, and tells her frantically and emphatically to sell your stock.
Mm-hmm.
Although she doesn't get the details, she actually has the insider information that selling time is here.
Yes.
So we should include her in that. And she go on and sell. She might be able to defend herself in court, but for our purposes, does she have the insider information? Yes. In other words, listen to this. Suppose you, Ms. Pemberton, suppose you were also an owner of this company. Nobody called you and told you to sell. You have no information, and therefore you will not sell in the morning.
Yes.
Nobody call Norma and tell Norma to sell. She will not sell. In fact, you, Ms. Pemberton, if Jean from Tobago call you and tell you, but you know, I ain't like shares and thing, you know, you them shares you always tell me own. Why you ain't sell them? You wouldn't sell them on that basis.
No.
But if Blake call you and tell you, girl, them shares you have in my company, sell that now. I'm practically telling you, sell that. And I mean, sell them now, frantic. That means you have some information different from Blake than you would have had from Jean Dong in Tobago, eh?
Yes.
Yes. So in that regard, you can include, in this case and for all purposes as securities professional, we include in Norma right there. Everybody understand?
Yes.
I want to stay with this because I want you to be able to see that you are not able to get up in the morning in 2019 and say to the commission, well, you know, we did this, but we really had no formal information from, I don't know, this corporate secretary of Bank of St. Vincent that there was going to be a takeover by the government in the morning. You can't say that, you know. The point is you knew something was wrong. And you have encouraged all your people, come and let me sell now before the price go down. Eh? You understand?
Sure.
Okay, let's take the next question there. I think this case is dragging us 5 minutes out of time. Let's take this question here, number four. So we say, Blake was a violator for sure. And Mr. Embleton, you just agreed. You told me that based on what we discussed, Norma is as well. So now we have... Yeah, if there were going to be some investigation into this case now, Richardson, who do you think would be?
Blake would be the main person for the investigation because she was the one who mentioned there was a theft.
Mm-hmm.
But Mr. Francis.
But also because she's the one who offloaded on the market, isn't it?
Yes, she is. But I wouldn't say Fleming would be as part of the investigation because Blake might be providing Fleming with false or misleading information. There is no police report to say that there was an actual theft. And she was the only one in the office. She only mentioned there was a theft, but then he never went on a police report or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So she would be the main person to go through the investigation.
Okay.
And also, she could also be, if it's because of false or misleading investigation, she could also be committing the offense of excessive trading to get commission for the company.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, in other words, you're saying if the theft is not true, she's just trying to make money on the trading of the shares.
Yeah.
Yes, okay, I understand that. But in the case, I mean, that could be a possibility, but in the case, let's assume that the theft was really true. Now, let me go to Fleming. Let me go to the broker, because the broker is who you are. We have to consider that the broker is also at fault here, because even if there was not a theft, just the instruction to sell that he got and all that, something is wrong, and his primary duty would have been to establish what it is that was wrong. So, mm-hmm. You know, that same police report, before he even take any action, he reports to his boss and he says, we're freezing transactions or trades in this company because here is a problem that I have been made aware of. We need to verify it before we continue trading.
Right. Yes.
So he still has not performed a fiduciary duty. He still has not performed a duty because he's a licensed person to all the investors in this firm. He had to make sure that whatever information it is, remember earlier on we said the information must be factual?
Mm-hmm.
Even before he called Venner or any one of them person and give them information and give them recommendation, his information should have been factual. He had to check that out. He's also negligent. He's complicit in the insider trading because he goes passing on the information without publishing it. He also takes action on it before it becomes public. And remember we said use a circular. He has not used a circular. He has just told some people and not told others. So we have all those violations in there.
Yeah.
All right. And above all, he actually is negligent, yeah? What procedures is he following, really, in the receipt and dissemination of information and in the processing of trades? What, you know, is he following? So those are some concerns that arise there as well. So he will be a target as well of the investigation because he's a broker, intermediary carrying out these trades. As a matter of fact, he might even be charged for not putting the reins on Blake. He might end up in jail before Blake. And he run the risk of being charged criminally under the Securities Act, but he run the risk of being charged by civil, you know, anybody who could just say that they were harmed because of his you know, improper action as a broker. And for you certificate seekers, you know, and licensed broker seekers, you are on the verge of being brokers. He is the one you should read our case and reread that case and find what he should have done. Look it back with the training that we've received and say that even though this is a ridiculous case, these are the circumstances which a broker should never find himself. And I, Payne, I, Green, I, Lewis, I, Pemberton, I, Richardson, I, Rome, Horn, and I, Anthony, I will never fall in this trap like this man. Okay, we out of time. The purpose of the case study is really for us to look at it. And we take the same approach for all the other questions. I apologize for the other persons who could not have the questions addressed during this session. But anything at all, you can always call me or speak to me through the email thing there. And we can discuss what else. I say it's an entertaining case, a very interesting case. But several of the things in there tie back to what you would have done in the customer account management, investor advisory services, and in the conduct of business session, as well as the conduct of business regulations. All right, any burning questions that would stop us from not closing now? Okay, if not, I would like to ask Ms. Farrell, Commission, to indicate us in terms of timing where we go.
Okay, so it's 12:38, and can we come back for 2:00? So that we have enough time to finish this afternoon session. Is that okay? Okay, so we'll be back for 2:00. So you have a little over an hour for them. Okay, so thanks to Mr. Francis, and we will be informative and interactive session. And we will see you back at, we'll be back this afternoon with Ms. Karina Brown of ECSE. And we will see you at 2:00.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being a good session, giving a good session today. And I look forward to seeing you at the practical in the next 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Bye.